This is the Tax Update Podcast for Thanksgiving, November 27th, 2008. This week, self-employed or not. The Tax Update Podcast, intended for tax professionals, is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners respect their own research before minds raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use includes using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information that tax practitioners that subscribe to their services visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Taking a couple of weeks off here as I've been traveling around doing CPE work, but we're back on just in time for you to load this up, hopefully on your machine or iPod, and head out to the Black Friday sales here in the U.S. just before we get into the whole Christmas buying season in the current year. And we're going to take a look at a case that came down the tax court this week involving FICA, self-employment taxes, and all those other neat little details. In a recent presentation at the Arizona Federal Tax Institute, James Hamill referred to the fact that in our generation of CPAs, those of us who started in practice before LLCs were prevalent, we knew there were two categories of partners under the Internal Revenue Code for self-employment tax purposes. There were limited partners, they didn't pay self-employment tax, and there were general partners who did pay self-employment tax. Well, as he pointed out in his presentation, unfortunately, that rule doesn't really exist anywhere in the code. Nowhere does the code refer to general partners or tell you general partners pay self-employment taxes. But it was a functional rule that many of us had learned. The hitch becomes this week, we're going to take a look at another functional rule that many practitioners work under, unfortunately, in error, the belief that if an individual does not have wage W-2 issued and receives compensation and no FICA was withheld from the wages, that it is incumbent upon the taxpayer to then report that amount as self-employment income and pay the self-employment tax, as if you get a credit, essentially, against self-employment income for having had the amount withheld from your wages. In this week's case, which involves a case of McWhorter versus Commissioner, TKC Memorandum Decision 2008-263, the tax court looks at the actual test involved in this case for whether or not Mr. McWhorter was subject to the self-employment tax. And that comes down to the question of whether Mr. McWhorter truly was or was not an employee. And an interesting change of position for the IRS versus what many of us are concerned about or see the issue when we see it in our practices, this week the IRS is claiming the individual in question was truly self-employed and was not actually an employee of the agency in question or the entity in question. Largely, we would presume, because the statute of limitations had closed off for going after the employer for the payroll taxes by the time this was done. So therefore, the only place the IRS had to collect the tax, because it will discover Mr. McWhorter hadn't filed his tax return for a couple of years, was to go against Mr. McWhorter for the self-employment income, for the self-employment tax, if the IRS planned to collect both sides. In fact, in this particular case, there were a number of issues Mr. McWhorter felt should be open to question when the IRS prepared their substitute for return for him. But by the time we got to the trial and the decision in this case, there really were only three issues that were in play. The first was whether Mr. McWhorter was liable for the self-employment tax on payments he received from Boyle Energy. He performed services for Boyle Energy in the year in question. As well, whether he was liable for the failure to pay penalty under Section 6651A because he had failed to file a return for 2002. He claimed he failed to file the return because he didn't want to sign a return that said he was an independent contractor, and the employer should have withheld the taxes anyway because he didn't want to sign that false return, he didn't file a return. And finally, whether he was liable for the penalty for failing to pay estimated taxes under Section 6664. Again, based on his belief that, in fact, the employer should have withheld the taxes, therefore there appeared to be no reason, there wouldn't have been any underpayment in his theory. And therefore, based on that theory, obviously there was no requirement to pay estimates. Now, the interesting aside is that while the IRS is going to carry two of these three provisions, they're going to lose the self-employment tax provision when we look at the facts in this case. First, let's take a look at the self-employment tax and FICA taxes and the two provisions in the code that deal with each. The self-employment tax is imposed under Section 1401 of the code, and it's imposed on self-employment income as defined in Section 1402, a provision we've discussed before in previous podcasts. That general definition tells us that for purposes of this, we have an individual operating alone, that net earnings from self-employment means that gross income derived by that individual from any trade or business carried on by that individual, less the deductions allowed by the subtotal that are attributable to such trade or business. Generally, an employee who is employed is considered to be in a trade or business. That's why we can still take our deductions under Section 162, albeit as employee business expenses on the Form 2106, when we file our individual income tax returns, because the claims are 162 claims, not 212 claims. The issue becomes that is a trade or business, and it's trade or business income that also arises when we're trying to compute the net operating loss deduction for an individual who also has wage income, that we have to factor that in as trade or business income. So it would appear that based on the general definition, that your wage income should be subject to self-employment tax. But Section 1402C2 provides a general exemption that tells us that self-employment income will not include the performance of service by an individual as an employee other than, and then it lists a set of specific exemptions that we find generally, in Section 3121 of the Code. Now, Section 3121 of the Code is found in the payroll tax provisions, and it's the definition of wages. Wages are what the FICA and Medicare taxes are imposed under Section 3101 of the Code. They impose the Medicare and FICA taxes involved in the code. And Section 3121 tells us that essentially this wage income is subject to those taxes. And that's defined generally as remuneration received for services as an employee. Now, an interesting aside is that there's nothing in either one of these sections that say if you pay one of the taxes, you don't pay the other. The mechanics is generally that's going to be true. But if you go back to our history, you can find there are cases where you pay neither. An early podcast done in this series, if you go back to the very beginning of this, back in 2005, I believe it was in July of 2005, you're going to find a podcast dealing with something called spiffs. Spiffs are amounts paid by generally car manufacturers to salespeople at car dealers. We discover under the IRS rulings dealing with that area and their publication that, in fact, in that situation, there is no FICA required because the employer paying, the person paying the compensation, is not the individual's employer. Therefore, that means that they don't have any FICA liability because that requires an employment relationship between the payor and the payee. But also, the recipient does not have to pay self-employment tax because the exemption we talked about there under Section 1402, this arises from their work as an employee, and it's a trade or business carried on as an employee. And for that reason, the FICA tax generally is, or I should say, the self-employment tax will not be applicable to that payment. And that was the first illustration and one of the first comments, one of the early podcasts we had on the whole self-employment issue, that deals with the fact that this does not break down to that nice, simple rule that says you will pay one or the other types of tax. In reality, you pay the one that applies. Let's take a look now at the McWhorter case. As noted initially, Mr. McWhorter failed to file a tax return for 2002. Well, he also failed to file for 2001, but that's not the matter at issue here. His failure to file 2002 was brought him to the attention of the IRS because Boyle Energy had issued a 1099 miscellaneous to him reporting $126,760 of payments of employee business expenses, or I should say non-employee compensation, that they claimed to have paid to Mr. McWhorter. Now, there's no question at trial that they actually paid Mr. McWhorter this $126,000, and he had failed to file any return to report this income. The key issue for self-employment tax purposes, now, Mr. McWhorter initially tried to claim he shouldn't be liable for the tax because it should have been withheld, it should have been covered by withholding. All of those positions were essentially conceded during the trial, and Mr. McWhorter agreed that the only issue involved was a question of whether he's subject to SE tax, as well as whether or not he was subject to the penalties. The court outlined the general arrangement between Boyle Energy and Mr. McWhorter as follows. It noted that commencing in 2001 and ending in 2004, Mr. McWhorter performed services as a project manager for Boyle Energy Services and Technology. Boyle hired the petitioner because of his knowledge of power plants and specialized knowledge and expertise in industrial pipe fitting. His work for Boyle focused on industrial cleaning of steam piping and power plants as part of the process of recommissioning the plants. He received no training from Boyle Energy regarding either its procedure or on industrial pipe fitting. His training by Boyle Energy was restricted to teaching him the recommissioning process of the company itself. His work for Boyle was on a project-by-project basis. He had the authority to supervise the personnel of Boyle Energy and of client companies. He did not have any hiring or firing authority over Boyle Energy personnel and had to contact Boyle Energy before removing his personnel from a job site. He did have a credit card with the name of Boyle Energy on it and a business card with the company logo on it. Mr. McWhorter invoiced Boyle Energy for services rendered per project. The invoices and subsequent payments were at a rate of $500 per day for his labor during 2002. He did not provide Boyle with timesheets, and Boyle paid the amount shown on the invoices and issued him a 1099 miscellaneous for 2002, reporting, as mentioned earlier, $126,760 as non-employee compensation. He received that same Form 1099 for Boyle from year 2001, 2002, 2003, and 2004, the 4 years he worked for them. He never received a Form W-2 from Boyle Energy during that period. Due to his failure to actually have filed a return, as we noted, the IRS prepared a substitute for return, and the court noted that they prepared the substitute for return under Section 6020B. In the notice of deficiency, the IRS determined that Mr. McWhorter was liable for the self-employment tax on the income received from Boyle Energy. And that's the principal matter in question that we're going to talk about in today's case. Mr. McWhorter initially disputed the entire assessment of all taxes against him. It appeared in his view that apparently this wasn't really his fault. He was an employee and should have been treated as an employee. Had he been treated as an employee, the wages, you know, taxes would have been withheld from his wages. As such, the tax would have been paid, and therefore there would be no liability, so he really shouldn't have a problem. Sometimes, to be honest, we discover clients that think this way. I'm sure we've all run into the non-filers in the past who were non-filers because they had enough withheld every year that they never had any tax due, and they just never got around to filing. Mr. McWhorter may have been one of those types of individuals when he worked previously, and as strange as it may seem, sometimes those individuals don't notice that there's nothing being withheld from the check. They just pick up a paycheck and don't even look to see how much money came out or whether any withholding was there. We don't know if that was Mr. McWhorter's case, but it's not totally out of the realm of possibility that a taxpayer could be that clueless about what's going on. But by the end of the trial, Mr. McWhorter had agreed that he clearly owed the income taxes and he was not going to be able to get out of paying the income taxes merely by claiming that the employer should have covered it through withholding. On the self-employment tax issue, though, the IRS claimed he was liable, and it believed the test applied as noted as noted by the court. The court noted that the IRS contended that petitioner is liable for self-employment tax under Section 1401A and 1402. The IRS argues that he was not an employee under the definition set out in Section 3121D. The IRS relies on the test set out in Bro and Daigle versus United States, a Fifth Circuit case from 1990, that cited the United States versus Silk, a U.S. Supreme Court case from 1947. And the following factors specifically are what the IRS is considering: the degree of control involved in this relationship, the opportunities for the individual to have profits or losses from the transaction, is he exposed to both, investment in facilities by Mr. McWhorter, the permanency of the relationship between the two parties, and the skill required in the operation in question. The court notes the list is not exclusive and no one factor is controlling. As we will discover, the IRS is going to agree that some factors broke for Mr. McWhorter in claiming he was an employee and some factors broke against him. But the IRS came to the conclusion that on balance, Mr. McWhorter was not an employee. And that's an interesting position because for the most part, we seem to be primarily concerned in many of the cases our clients deal with the IRS taking the position somebody is an employee. But let's remember that in this particular case, the ability to go after Boyle Energy for the unpaid payroll taxes didn't exist anymore. It appears that year was closed by the time all of this got started. So the IRS's only hope of going after the tax was to go after Mr. McWhorter in this case and get the money from him. The IRS conceded that of the factors they had listed, the following ones would argue against their position, would argue that Mr. McWhorter was an employee of Boyle Energy. First, the question of an opportunity for profit or loss. Mr. McWhorter really had no particular ability to basically throw off a loss from this transaction. Reality is that the transaction was only going to be paid as fees. He was incurring no real major expenses against that $500 per day fee. So by the end of the day, about all he could do was pocket the money. That's very similar to an employee who generally has no risk of loss because they're going to get their paycheck and they don't incur significant expenses in performing the services for the employer. As well, the IRS noted that Mr. McWhorter hadn't invested in any facilities. That is a similar issue to his opportunity for profit or loss. Generally, if you're working as a true contractor for somebody, for instance, here my accounting firm, we work as an outside consultant or contractor for all of our clients, and we have here an investment in all the property, plant, and equipment of the accounting firm, the computers I'm using, the other equipment in my office, the desks, everything is ours, it's not the client's. An employee tends to have all of these provided. For instance, our staff accountants have these provided by us to them for performing their services for us. The IRS agreed that Mr. McWhorter did not have a significant investment in equipment, and for general matters, he was using the equipment provided by Boyle. However, the IRS felt that the following three factors argued in favor of Mr. McWhorter being an independent contractor. The IRS claimed there was a lack of permanency in the relationship. As an employee, you're generally presumed to stay on as an employee until such time as you're told basically to go home. He was being hired on a project-by-project basis. As such, the IRS took the position that didn't show any reasonable expectation of permanency. Rather, he was hired for specific jobs and specific projects rather than being on the payroll as an employee would normally be. On degree of control, the IRS argued that Mr. McWhorter had a lot of freedom available to determine how he was going to approach the project. They weren't looking directly over his shoulder in handling how the project could be handled. An employee generally has a stronger level of supervision by the employer over the employee. An independent contractor, for instance, when I prepare a tax return for a client or we do tax planning for a client, I have a lot of leeway in how I handle the project and how I handle the situation, including things like scheduling. Are in my control. Finally, skill required in the operation. The IRS noted that Boyle didn't provide him with any skills. He was brought in because of specialized skills he possessed. These may be skills that makes more sense to outsource because there may not be enough work to make sense to have somebody on the payroll who can provide those skills. Secondly, the employee often looks to the employer to provide the basic skill sets that are going to be required, or at least to provide additional skills. In this particular case, the skills already existed. Mr. McWhorter was hired because he possessed these specific skills that were necessary for this job. It was a specialized set of skills, and according to the IRS, that made him look more like a contractor. Finally, and most importantly, the IRS argued that, recognizing that the case is close, the IRS believed that the mere fact that Mr. McWhorter had essentially acquiesced in this treatment, had gone ahead every year and continued to work under this arrangement knowing he was not going to receive a W-2, indicates that he should not be allowed, here as we take a look at this situation and go forward, to be able to claim that he now should be treated as an employee when he had gone along all along with being an independent contractor. The IRS notes that while he contends there was an ongoing dispute with Boyle Energy regarding his status, he acknowledged, however, that he worked under this arrangement for 2001 until he ended the relationship in 2004 for totally unrelated reasons. If there was a valid dispute as to his status, the IRS argued, Mr. McWhorter essentially acquiesced to Boyle's understanding of his status by continuing to work under this arrangement. And despite the availability of persons aware of his employment status and relationship with Boyle Engineering over the period in question, such as Mike Boyle and Diane Gagnon, petitioner did not obtain any evidence to corroborate his testimony where it is at variance with documentary evidence. The tax court noted, however, that the IRS similarly could have produced its own evidence regarding the nature of the relationship. They weren't going to allow the IRS, since they could have called these individuals as well, to imply that, in fact, there was something different than what was documented. The court also noted specifically Mr. McWhorter's evidence to be believable, and that the court felt the lack of other corroborating evidence did not overcome this testimony. As we've noted before, quite often the taxpayer's impression when telling his story to the court is key, the impression he makes on the court. This case is even more interesting since the tax court didn't seem essentially predisposed to believe the testimony of somebody who was a non-filer and who was apparently trying to get out of paying the tax entirely by his initial arguments. I would have to presume that Mr. McWhorter made an extremely favorable impression on the court in this manner, and it may not be totally coincidental that the fact that the court said he eventually agreed that the taxes for income taxes, etc., would be due may indicate that when the court explained the basis to them or why the tax would normally be due, that he appeared to understand and accept rather than continuing to fight the whole issue and keep moving forward. He rather gave up and only retreated back to the question of whether he was employed for self-employment tax purposes. The court did agree with the IRS that Mr. McWhorter's acceptance of that status quo for the 4 years was troubling, but it noted that his acquiescence in Boyle's treatment of him as an independent contractor for tax purposes is troubling, as noted. But as the court discussed later on the opinion, he presented no reasonable excuse for his failure to file a return and pay the income tax due. That's another negative, it seems, the court's indicating, for why we might have trouble believing him. However, on the limited record the court noted that we have, we conclude that Mr. McWhorter was an employee of Boyle Energy in 2002 and should have been treated as such for tax purposes. Mr. McWhorter appears to have barely skinned by on this one, and in fact, as we discover reading on later, it appears the key issue became who bore the burden of proof in this case. The tax court discussed the question of whether the taxpayer put in credible evidence that would serve to shift the burden of proof in the position discussing the IRS's claim that the burden had not shifted. The court noted the IRS's pretrial memorandum. The IRS referred to Section 7491A and asserted that Mr. McWhorter had failed to produce any evidence that he was an employee and not an independent contractor of Boyle. At trial, however, the nature of Mr. McWhorter's employment was the subject of Mr. McWhorter's testimony, and that testimony, the court notes, was creditable. In the post-trial brief, the IRS does not challenge the credibility of the testimony and acknowledges that some of the relevant factors favor the petitioner. The tax court concluded, therefore, that the burden had shifted to the IRS and that the IRS failed to carry that burden. The court indicates we are not persuaded that the factors relied upon by the IRS proves the petitioner was an independent contractor with respect to the services he performed for Boyle. Neither the degree of control exercised by Boyle nor the amount of skills possessed by Mr. McWhorter distinguished his situation from that of a supervisory employee. Now, that's key because, as far as the court could see, a regular supervisor for Boyle would probably have had the same skill level and would have probably exercised the same sort of discretion in carrying out his job. We are not persuaded that a job to continue from 2001 to 2004 can be described as impermanent. The IRS acknowledges that other factors favor the petitioner. On the record that has been made, the court concludes that the respondent did not carry the burden of proof, and that, therefore, Mr. McWhorter is not liable for self-employment tax for 2002. Essentially, the court found that all five factors favored Mr. McWhorter at the end of the day. The court also notes that deciding whether Mr. McWhorter was an employee does open up the question of his responsibility for paying the employee's share of the FICA and Medicare tax. But it notes the implication of our holding that petitioner was an employee of Boyle Energy for 2002 is that he may be liable for his share of taxes under the Federal Insurance Contribution Act, Section 3101A and B. That determination, however, is not within our jurisdiction in this case. In this particular case, it was not a matter before the court. Technically, Mr. McWhorter should have been paying at least his half because half of the FICA is imposed on him. And while it was not withheld from his paycheck, he was still liable for that side. He would not have been liable for the employer side of the FICA because that would have gone back over to Boyle Energy. Boyle Energy, who basically has a closed statute at this point for 2002, or presumptively does. Therefore, the IRS is just stuck on that part of the tax. When it came to penalties, though, Mr. McWhorter did not fare as well, since he didn't have any decent explanation as far as the court was concerned for his failure to deal with his 2002 taxes, either getting payments in or actually filing the return. On the penalty for late filing under 6651A, the court noted that his only explanation of his failure to file a return for 2002 is that he did not want to sign a return saying he was employed a contractor. He has no reasonable cause, however, for failing to file a return reporting that he received $126,760 in compensation and other amounts of income during 2002. The failure of Boyle Energy to withhold taxes that should have been withheld neither excuses petitioner's failure to file a tax return and pay the taxes, nor relieves him to the additions of tax under the failure to file penalty. Mr. McWhorter could have filed a return that reported those amounts as wages and volunteered to pay the employee FICA. That was perfectly acceptable if he didn't want to take the position or was going to avoid taking the position on the return that, in fact, the payments represented self-employment income. But what he can't do is fail to file a return in total. Our clients sometimes get confused about this matter. I've heard more than once people claim, well, I can't file the return because we don't know the answer. Or, you know, we had a 1099 issued that's wrong, it's not been corrected, well, therefore, we can't file the return until the 1099 is corrected. As this case makes clear, that's not the way the law works. Regardless of the reporting by third-party payers, we are required to file a proper income tax return. And that means we file the return as stated. If we have differences with the 1099s, obviously, we're going to expect some correspondence and have to deal with the IRS. But let's face it, Mr. McWhorter had to deal with the IRS regardless in this case. The issue that we don't file a return, we file the return based upon what we believe to be the taxes that are due, based upon the best information available. And having done that, we sign the jurat. And if the jurat's signed by the taxpayer and the taxpayer reasonably believes the return's proper, there is no problem filing that return, even when there's a 1099 out there that apparently should have been a W-2. Now, the penalty for underpayment of estimated taxes was also found to be due by the court. The court noted that each in the required installment is equal to 25% of the annual payment. And the required annual payment is a lesser of 90% of the tax shown on the return for the taxable year, or if the taxpayer filed no return, 90% of the tax for that year, or 100% of the tax shown on the return for the preceding year. Because he failed to file a return for 2001, his required annual payment for 2002 was 90% of the tax for that year. And since he paid no federal income tax for 2002, the underpayment of estimated tax penalty applies to his underpayment. Now, in conclusion, this is another one of those cases that we keep running into where we look at the issue of FICA, Medicare taxation, and self-employment tax continues to rotate through the code. In this case, interestingly enough, the taxpayer was able to show, or at least was able to show the IRS failed to carry the burden of proof that he was not an employee under the rules. So the IRS, at the end of the day, the court decided he was an employee primarily because they decided the IRS had not carried its burden and the burden had shifted. Now, many of us might have been happier with a result where the IRS had won this issue, but won this issue not on the fact that he had gone along with the agreement, but won it on the factual basis of the five tests. Because quite often, we're trying to defend clients where the IRS payroll people are attempting to come back after us for unpaid FICA, unpaid payroll taxes, by claiming individuals should have been treated as employees. An IRS win on this case on the merits of the five-factor test rather than the merits on whether they had just acquiesced and agreed could have been an interesting case that might have helped us argue the other direction for those individuals that we want to say are not employees. But in this case, the court went ahead and essentially ruled that Mr. McWhorter was properly treated as an employee. As well, it's important to note sometimes that if you have a taxpayer who didn't understand that he should have been treated as an employee and the proper treatment was employee, that we can take the position and file the return with wage claims and then make the position that we are an employee on the return. Now, that generally has implications because obviously what that's going to do if push comes to shove is we're going to get into a deal with the employer where the IRS may be looking at them for payroll tax issues, so it could be a quick way, unfortunately, for the individual to get fired. But as a practical matter, we can still file the proper return and do it correctly. The mere fact we don't think they're a self-employed individual does not mean we don't file a return. As Mr. McWhorter made, as was made clear to Mr. McWhorter, that simply isn't the solution. Coming up here, I'm continuing and doing more CP presentations in the next few weeks. In fact, that's the main reason why we've had a tough time getting these podcasts out in recent weeks, as I've been on the road quite a bit. Upcoming immediately next week, I'm going to do presentations on tax and accounting issues for construction contractor in Cincinnati, Ohio on Monday. I'm going to do full day courses on fringe benefits first in Dayton, Ohio on Tuesday, and then Columbus, Ohio on Wednesday for the Ohio Society of CPAs. After that, I head to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma to present a technology update at the Oklahoma Tax Institute on Friday, one of the sessions during their two-day conference. The week following that, I've got 2 days in Bend, Oregon, where I'm going to do first a session on current federal tax developments on Tuesday, and then basic estate and gift taxes on Wednesday. And for the state societies, I will close out the year doing 2 4-hour courses in Greensboro, North Carolina on the Wednesday of the following week, doing one on fringe benefits and another on succession planning. In addition, in the mix of all that, I will also have three separate presentations for in-house presentations for firms at various locations during that time period. So I'm pretty much booked solid for the next 3 weeks after this week finishes. If you are able to come to one of those state society presentations, or if you're in one of those firms and you're going to be watching, I'll look forward to meeting you or seeing you there. Otherwise, we'll hopefully get out these as we come forward and see the changes. We also know there is a possibility the Congress will come back for a lame duck session and may make some changes to the tax code there. We'll be keeping an eye on what happens there, if anything, to tax law changes. As always, this has been the Tax Update, brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Be sure to consider going there and subscribing to their email newsletters on tax-related matters. This has been your Thanksgiving Day Tax Update.